Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, and producer Vince Vaughn. I think I could have benefited from a good dose of Vince Vaughn when I was a kid. He didn't let school labels define him, and he saw no need to ask permission to pursue whatever interested him most. He moved out to Hollywood to pursue acting at age 18, and when things weren't happening as fast as planned, he and Jon Favreau wrote themselves into breakout roles with the cult classic Swingers. Why not? And when people didn't think he was funny enough to cast in a studio comedy, he proved them wrong with Old School, and even more wrong with Wedding Crashers and The Breakup. It's hard to reach that level of success, and even harder to stay honest with yourself once you're there. And that's what I loved about talking to Vince. As successful as he's become, he remains a hardworking, reflective guy who questions and pushes himself as an artist. That's led him to some of his best and surprisingly dramatic work yet. It's what makes him continually fascinating to watch and equally fascinating to talk with. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Vince.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming and doing this.
Good to be with you.
You know, I should say right at the start that I met you over 20 years ago.
That's right.
Right after Swingers happened, and I photographed you for Vanity Fair.
You're right.
And you were a young kid, and I was a young kid, and we did a photo shoot in a barbershop on Melrose in the middle of Hollywood.
I remember.
Sort of a hip barbershop.
Those were some of my favorite photos. You find those always popping up.
Well, it was definitely a time capsule, obviously, for you with the film. And for me, I was living in Beechwood Canyon in Hollywood at the time. And I was going to the Derby, and I was going
sure.
to...
I was right just east of you in the Oaks in Los Feliz.
In the Oaks. Well, you know, when Swingers came out, I wasn't an actor, but I was a photographer, and I was hustling in the same way. And, and I was surrounded by those guys trying to get jobs. And we all had sort of a lot of free time during the day.
For sure.
Because we didn't have as much work as we had ambition. And so I just wanted to ask you about your impressions of that time.
It was one of those things where it was really authentic to that neighborhood and what was going on. So it was nothing that came that was generated from a concept. It was really...
Right. People weren't making up Marty and Elaine.
No. That was really the... It was, you know, before I had ever met John, I had lived in that area. I always had liked it. And it's that combination where is the rent cheaper at the time, right? And then what happens when you have a lot of people who are photographers or actors or people into the arts, then you get... cool kind of interesting places that pop up because people want to go out locally.
Sure.
And so as a result, this neighborhood was really alive because it was just amazing to go hear 15-piece band play.
Yeah, the Derby was just this, the roof was this exposed beam, big dome, the bar was in the middle.
It felt like a time gone by, and the music was, although new songs, it wasn't cover songs.
Right.
So it wasn't like, hey, we're kind of listening to cover songs and into kind of something that happened. It was... contemporary in that it was kind of new and happening just here, but it had the flair of a different time. And I think the pendulum had swung so far in the direction, kind of with piercings and, you know, different things, that it was sort of a throwback to kind of more suits and girls in dresses and
right.
kind of the fun of swing dancing. So I just lived in the neighborhood, and that's where I'd go out at night. And like you said, I think you're really in pursuit of growing and learning. It's an exciting time that the Beverly Theater was there. I used to go watch the double features there.
And yep, $2.
$2, you'd get to watch great movies. It was so much fun. So when I met John, I was, you know, once you leave high school, in my case, I moved out to Los Angeles, but or after college, you don't know the girls in a way where it's comfortable to go up to them.
Right.
So you start to go, well, how do I go up to somebody that I have no class with? And then there's also fear of rejection.
Yeah.
So you're kind of nervous too, depending on the type of person you are. It can be intimidating. I don't know this person, I'm going up to them, and you put a high value on that. So for me, just being 18 and going out at night, I just always liked, you know, talking to girls and meeting girls and stuff. And so you start to figure things out, you know, like anything. You start to go, oh, well, say this or this happens. And it's less, I think, of a system of kind of like wordplay, like things that came out later. And I think it's more learning how to carry yourself and
right.
figure out what is it that you're interested in. And, you know, being able to be relaxed and be yourself. So it was just sort of where I was at in my life. And when I met John on Rudy, he sort of moved to the area I was living in, and I just sort of brought him out to these places, and I think he was really taken by it because it was so unique.
Right.
I remember when the script was written, I said, you know, gosh, I said, we're just auditioning for stuff, and it all feels kind of lame, to be honest, and maybe we should come up with, like, you know, our own story. I might write my own script. And then 2 weeks later, John had written Swingers and handed it to me. And I think because the world was there, those places were real, the music was happening, it just was sort of an exciting world that took place. And then he took a very personal thing, obviously. He had left a girlfriend behind to move out there. And it was sort of this guy in a new environment with kind of this, you know, tour guide.
Yeah.
Who was kind of encouraging and saying, hey, you know, these things are possible for you. And then, of course, he just, which is his own skill set, crafted a great screenplay and a great story. But I think what you're recognizing is correct, that it was authentic to the place he was in. And it was both, you know, as a state and also location-wise.
Well, the script and the film, it does a neat trick, which is that in the very beginning of the film, it lays out its premise so plainly. That scene with Ron Livingston where he says, to be able to get the girl interested in you, you have to forget the girl. And then that's exactly what happens in the movie. And yet when it happens in the movie, we're all so there and rooting for him. And it made me wonder if going through that process with John, and I'm sure you guys did a lot of rewrites and working on it, if you got interested in script architecture through seeing that independent project work so well.
Well, for me, I started to get interested, I think, partially out of survival. So first, you want to be an actor, but you start to learn about all aspects, and you're curious. So even on a set, you'd start to figure out stuff, and an appreciation.
Yeah.
Because film is really a bunch of different art forms combined. You know, there's the visual, there's the composition of the picture.
Sure.
There's obviously writing, and then there's performance within that, and music, and so many different elements coming together. So in pursuit of understanding character, it kind of leads you in that direction. And I was always a big reader on in and of myself. So I definitely, the thing that was interesting about that is I think there's something that's true in life, which is it is true that you have to kind of get over a relationship before you're kind of ready or open to let a new one in, right?
Right, yeah.
Which I think makes it very rootable because he's not a guy just looking for just a physical encounter.
Right.
That is based in being deceitful. You know, he's really a person on a real journey who is wearing his pain on his sleeve. And so he's more searching to feel good and connect
right.
than he is about anything else. So I think there's something in that, as pathetic as it is, depending on how you look at it, there's also something I think that's very winning about that, that he's unable to be compartmentalized.
That's right. You know, it's funny. This was a year before Good Will Hunting,
mm-hmm.
and I think Matt and Ben got that title placed on them as, you know, two guys who made their own future by creating this thing. But you guys pretty much did that exact thing a year before. I mean, you really...
And there was people prior to us.
Sure.
You know, there's those examples, and I think that's a great thing for anyone out there, you know, allowing yourself to say, I'm curious about this, and then you have to kind of give yourself permission and figure it out, right?
You have to make your own opportunities, for sure.
It came really of a continuation of pursuing, as in life, I think, trying to better understand concepts or philosophies. You know, when you're younger, someone says, what do you think love is? I think you say, well, I think it's this, but you haven't really thought about it. And then as you get older, you start to get more solid ideas of what it is, and it changes. But I don't know that you ever stop evolving.
Well, that would be,
you know what I mean?
That would be the end or death, right?
Right.
We have to keep evolving.
So I think the self-generating came from that. Frustrated or feeling like, I don't know, that this is passionate for me.
When he brought the script to you, was it something that was already set up or was it something?
No,
that...
I mean, the first thing is I thought there's so many things here that I've said. You know, I mean, there's like real conversations, exaggerated with extra
right.
monies or babies. But there was, you know, think beautiful babies. Those were things that I would say, you know, all knowing that we were joking, right? So
right.
you would have this kind of point of view with a wink, you know, knowing that you're kind of being fun with these expressions. So it felt, you know, the character felt very derivative of comedic things I had said or moments. But what I was really impressed with was the simplicity of such a well-organized journey that was so non-try-hard, but very impactful. So it was really very quickly laid out in a really great structural way, you know.
Was his talent also observing? Like, when you read the script and you saw yourself in there and your phrases, you know, did a light bulb go on of, oh, he's picking up on those things and finding ways to make them.
Well, I thought it was clever, you know, and I think he took something personal to him and did that. So, but it was really kind of that thing that I don't know, as I was saying before, that you have to go back and remind yourself constantly, and I think that's true for anyone out there. You can feel so far away from something that you're curious about. It's to me, even it's less about the results, although we all like results. It's more, you know, having the courage to listen to that whisper. Why am I curious to explore this?
Right.
Well, I'm looking all around for someone to give me permission to explore something.
Yeah.
And then you say, no, I'm just going to start building it and doing it. And you always come on the other side of that realizing you had so much more control or power or value than you felt at the time.
Well, see, value, I think, is a key word there. Because when you say value, I could see an alternate reality where you read it and you just have insecurity about, well, who's going to be interested about this?
But I think in the moment that you're in your life, if you're conscious on some level, not in all levels, but in the pursuit of, in this case, storytelling, then it was easy to say, at least I believe in this.
Yeah.
That I feel like it's ringing true. It was just that time of being young and passionate and uncompromising and feeling like this feels true and giving you enough steam to kind of defend the story and one to make it in the way that we did.
Well, that speaks to a confidence, like to be in your early 20s and to realize that time is, that it is unique and it is valuable and it is true.
It appears to me that sometimes it's getting to a point of being frustrated.
Yeah.
Putting yourself in that position of being dependent on someone else. Look at today now, where it's such a more democratic process, filmmaking. It's so much, you know, people get a camera, they can edit stuff. There's more at their disposal.
Sure.
So any sort of getting out there and storytelling or putting something together, I think, is valuable. You know, you're learning and experimenting and playing around. And more time spent on that, I think, ultimately leads to, you know, more say in your existence and more confidence and resolve in your existence, the more time kind of training and waiting. You know, you can kind of do both.
What was the film a reaction to for you guys? Was it a reaction to a bunch of auditions that didn't pan out or the parts that you were getting not being as interesting as the ones that you wanted to play?
I mean, it was both. I mean, we weren't getting all the stuff. But I think it was, I said to John, this stuff isn't that great. We're not getting this stuff, and we should write something. So I'm going to write something. And he obviously was, you know, a very talented writer, and I think the improv and stuff that he did had prepared him for that very well. And it was just kind of that the timing was right. And then that opened up a different door where you could then, you know, kind of self-generate. But even separately, where movies are concerned and anything that you're interested in life, I think giving yourself permission to get started is always going to bring better rewards than feeling that illusion, right? It's almost like Wizard of Oz, isn't it?
Exactly.
You're searching for the wizard to tell you how to do it, but in the pursuit of overcoming fears and learning things.
So take me back to coming out to LA, because that in itself is an incredibly bold move. To make a decision, I mean, I know you decided to go straight there after high school. You didn't go to college, and you came from pretty straight-laced Midwest parents. It wasn't like you had two hippie parents.
Right. They were both extremely hardworking. And I think my dad, as I got older, became more successful. He started his own business when I was 8 and kind of finally looked like everything was fine by the time I was probably like 11 or 12. But he, you know, he grew up, he'd go see his father in the summer with no indoor plumbing.
Oh, really?
On a 100-acre farm, and he'd work in his dad would work in the factories to keep the farm going, you know, railroads. So he was always like, my dad was from that generation, you know, never cheap and generous with people, but for himself and on his own, you know, coupons.
Right.
Why would you shop there? you know, just the way they were raised with his mom, they had so little, you know. And my mom was similar in the same way and wanted better for their kids, I think, like most folks do.
But he was a self-made dude.
Self-made guy. He put himself through college, you know, started working when he was, I think, 10, selling newspapers on the corner, you know, just driven not to change his circumstances. So I was fortunate because he would say to me younger, which I really appreciated, he didn't put a big value on that you had to make a lot of money. I think he really was opposed to people that's focus was financial, like that somehow would mean something. He used to say you could put a suit on somebody and they're still a stolen car. Don't make them an honest guy, Vince. But they were very encouraging. And I think my dad came out more on, I don't care if you do make money or not. You got to take care of yourself, obviously. You're going to have to support yourself.
Right,
so you have to
figure
it out. But I just care that you really don't lie to yourself, that you really pursue it.
Well, it's funny. When I was watching a bunch of stuff and preparing for this conversation, it seems like from a young age and always throughout your life, you're really comfortable being yourself in front of strangers. And I wanted to ask if you knew from a fairly early age that whatever you were going to do would sort of involve putting yourself out there, mm-hmm. putting yourself on a stage, being comfortable in front of total strangers.
I don't know if I knew it from that point, but I think I'm similar to most people, and I think all people, the pendulum on all sides of it, where I could be painfully shy younger.
Is that true?
In moments, I could feel real, shy. I mean, even part of the, going back to first moving out here, part of getting good at feeling comfortable was putting yourself out there. You know, you get to that place where, as strong as the fear is, maybe you compensate that much stronger by developing skills and facing those fears, you know. And
right.
I don't know where I come out, but school for me younger was, I remember, you know, I think it's so much is kind of shaped, you kind of, I don't know what clicks in your mind, but I did very well on an IQ test, but yet there were certain subjects that I just had a hard time paying attention or comprehending. And this was in the 70s, so they didn't dress it up. They just said you were kind of not smart in a certain
right.
area. But I remember being like forced to go to like one class a day where like they would really make you feel kind of bad, like it was bad to have your name called over the speaker. And all the kids in the class, I always felt like when I saw Cuckoo's Nest, I felt like I related to McMurphy in that, because I could always make jokes and, you know, was pretty good at disarming a situation and being confident. Not that I didn't feel insecure, but I just, for whatever reason, made up my mind I wasn't going to allow it. But at the time, at first I felt like, well, I'm not, these kids kind of, you know, really have problems and I don't belong here. And then I felt very kind of protective because I realized, and like other kids, you know, in school too, everyone had their stuff, right? Like, so I always liked Breakfast Club or that Stephen King book, Rage, I liked quite a bit.
Yeah. And
then I found acting. My parents put me in different stuff when I was a kid. Just, you know, they both worked. And I thought, well, I'm getting a good response here. And I like this. And I wasn't getting a good response always with all this stuff with academics.
Right.
Some subjects, very good. And some subjects were just, I realized later I learned differently. I just didn't learn the way I was being taught, which I think is true for some people. So I don't know that it was anything more than sort of having those normal fears and insecurities and having an area where maybe there's a little bit of a ray of light, so you kind of push more in that area. And I think it's a journey to learn to be comfortable with yourself, which part of it is, I think, is realizing that you're not great or perfect at everything. And then maybe having a sense of humor
right,
about those things.
But I still think to be 18 and go, I'm making this giant decision. I'm not going where 90% of the kids are going. I'm not going to go to college. I'm just going to.
Well, that
I
was
know
easy.
I'm going to act.
Once you make the decision that you're going to try to not let the fear or the people around you who doubt you'd get the best of you, you will push. That goes away. So I was going to the city and performing when I wasn't even old enough to be in the bars. I was performing live and doing improv and taking classes. I found that when I could drive, I was really loved it, so I would pursue it. And I just didn't listen to the rules a lot with certain stuff. If I liked something, I would pursue it, and I'd go, well, I'll figure this out, how to do it. I wouldn't sit back and have someone say, this is how you have to go about it. So I would just kind of pursue the things I was interested in. So by the time I got to be 18, I think that bridge had been crossed from much younger. I was so in a hurry just to say, well, this feels fun, and what does it mean? And I really like doing it. And I think part of it did come out of just you know, an area where you felt like you had positive reinforcement.
When you talk about going in and out of improv when you're in high school for what, a 3 or 4 month period?
Yeah, for about 4 months.
Versus some people who work so hard to get there and that's their whole path. Like their trajectory is either Second City or Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Or improv comedy that turns into comedy that turns into a sitcom. Did you, at that point, did you have another idea of acting in your head, like a?
Yeah, that was never my calling. You know, I took to it very, very well, and I enjoyed it, and I got a lot of opportunities very early. And improv became something I use a lot in film, and I think it really is writing. It's just, you know, some people actually write by talking stuff out. But it, and I was a big fan of the original SNL and loved that stuff. But it wasn't my calling. I never had a dream of being a regular.
You didn't want to be John
or being
Belushi
on stage every day. Well, I love those guys, of course, Belushi. Candy was probably my favorite. I just, the warmth of John Candy, I always loved. I just think I was really curious about human psychology, and there was something to me fascinating that in watching these stories and kind of being moved by them and learning a little bit about myself, or it was the same in reading a book. Did you have that experience, Shankar, when you, and that Stephen King book is one that I mentioned, Rage, he wrote Richard Bachman, you read those things and someone is crystallizing emotions and feelings that you're having,
yes,
that you understand perfectly in your own language that doesn't translate. So it's that feeling of connecting to someone, speaking to that inner understanding of yourself and the world around you.
Yeah.
That became very electric to me. I feel isolated. I feel this or I feel that. And this is kind of interesting because I'm learning about it now. I'm getting different perspective on it.
Right.
If that makes sense.
So how do you choose LA over New York? I mean, how does that happen to where?
Well, I think I was a product. You know, I had done some stage plays and stuff, but I was a product of my time. It was movies that I was fascinated with.
Is there a particular movie that you saw and you said that's
boy,
where
a lot of
be?
Them. Cuckoo's Nest spoke to me a lot because I just felt like that in school. I think it taught me a lot of empathy because I knew what it was like to feel less than or excluded. And although I did have the ability to be very confident, I had two older sisters, so I was verbally very prepared for any kind of argument. But it was an interesting, when I saw that movie, it was impactful. But my dad really loved Westerns. So I used to watch a lot of Westerns with him, something to do with my dad. So Shane was a big one for us.
Yeah.
The only movie Brando directed, which was One Eye Jacks, which is a great movie. The Wild Bunch. So I used to watch those. My dad would get a kick out of the Western. So we'd talk about them and what does that mean and why did he do that? You know, all those conversations that
right.
first start when you're exploring that stuff.
And then you just decide, I'm going to go to L.A. and I'm going to get an agent.
Because of the movies, that's what I was interested in. So I thought they make movies in Los Angeles. And I had gotten...
Did you have a friend or a connection or anything out here? So how does that day happen when you get in the car and you come
out? Well, I was terrified I wasn't going to graduate high school. I was terrified they were going to... I used to have reoccurring dreams that they were holding me back.
Really?
I wanted to get
you
out.
You wanted to get your life started so bad.
I just wanted to get out. But I was, and again, I had a lot of good friends and there was a lot of good classes and classes I did very well in certain subjects. But I remember my junior year, the senior class president had to give a speech for graduation. So I figured, oh, that's perfect, because they can't hold me back. Because you can't hold back the guy who's got to give a speech. So all the kids that were running were the typical kids who wanted it on their resume.
For college.
Harvard or somewhere, right.
Right.
And I just wanted to graduate, so I won.
So you're a senior class president.
I was, but I did it really because I truly in my mind felt that they can't stop me. Because there was a couple, I cut some classes and there was a few things that if it didn't go right, I would have had to repeat. It was my worst nightmare. So I had already made my mind up that that's where they do this stuff full time. And Chicago was, culturally it's fantastic. The museums there are great. The training there is phenomenal. They have very good, Steppenwolf and the Goodman. They have great theater and that kind of stuff. So I was really lucky to have that around me growing up and a lot of great influences. But the job opportunities were in California. So I had, my parents didn't let me get an agent. I thought, I have to get an agent. My dad said, you're not going to do anything like that.
You mean before you're 18?
Yeah, like before you're 18. He said, I can pursue that. When you're 18, you can do what you want, but you got to graduate high school. And then when I came out here, it was a first year was really no work at all.
How much money did you have when you drove out?
Well, I had a lot of money because I did a National Chevy commercial. And back in those days, I mean, they could show you for a second the residuals were unbelievable.
Okay, so you had a little nest egg.
I had a big nest egg comparatively. I mean, you made a lot of money. I mean, you made real money on those commercials.
Wow. And so when you came out, how did you navigate your way?
I just loved it. I was just
I mean, how did you find an agent out there in LA?
Well, I had a recommendation of someone that was at a bigger agency, ICM, and I remember calling the agent and saying, you know, I want to sign with you. They said, we just represent like people who work and, you know, people that can open movies. We don't work with people kind of starting off. I said, well, I'm just 18. They said, well, we can recommend you to someone that was an assistant that became an agent at a different place. And I tried to, you know, say to them, well, I'm not sure I'm going to sign with you. I'm really shopping around. You know, I think they got a kick out of it. So I met with this woman who was next to Pink's Hot Dogs. It was a small little agency next to Pink's Hot Dogs. And I think the big client that they had was the girl that was on Small Wonder. So when she would come in, the whole agency would shut down. She was their big client.
She was their money maker.
Yeah, she was their money maker. But they were just impressed. They said, he came out and he's sitting in an agent's office. So they were kind of like, I had a resume. I was SAG, which back then was more difficult to get.
Sure, sure.
Because you couldn't get in just through hours and stuff.
Right.
And then they were very nice to me. They recommended me some acting classes and they sent me out a lot. So I was very fortunate that way. Just sort of the chance worked out that way. But I didn't book anything and it was a good run of getting turned down.
Were you a good auditioner?
Terrible, I think. I was terrible.
Really? What, like, when you say terrible, what does that mean?
Well, it's just how I learn. If I can memorize something and not think about it, you know, then I can inhabit it more. But if I'm pulling something off a page, then some people are very good at that. But even if I'm reading out loud, I don't have command over something. I'd have to read it to myself a couple times before I could read it out loud and feel like I wouldn't be fumbling it.
You know what, that brings up an interesting point about the work that you have to do that no one sees. It's like you're saying, anyone can memorize a line or anyone can look at a page and say words to someone and someone can say those words back that are written. But if you don't make decisions about why those words are being said, it's like faking it versus really owning it.
I think there's more than one way to the waterfall. There's not one right way to do it. People's minds work differently. There's different ways to approach it.
Right.
I don't make a lot of choices. I've done that way, and I've had people, I've been coached in that way, and it didn't work for me as well where I made choices, although I think it's totally valid. But when I say the lines, meaning I have to really know the lines without knowing them, meaning I have to know them well enough that I'm not thinking about them. But I had a different way in. You know, a lot of times I did improvise a lot, but a lot of scenes looked improvised, but not improvised, because the improvisation to me is that I don't know what necessarily how I'm going to react or what they're going to do. So you kind of try to stay understanding who you are in that circumstance and what's going on, you know, going into that with your expectations and then reacting, hopefully honestly, to how they're met or not met.
Right.
I think for me, one of my litmus tests was I had a lot of exposure to lots of different walks of life younger. I was much more of an observer than I was you know, out there. But I could, for me, always as a litmus test, say, I don't, that doesn't feel honest to me. I don't believe that guy and that girl would go home or she would forgive him for that.
Right.
That guy's not scaring anybody. That guy wouldn't be afraid of him. So I think that, you know, watching different things and live, going out and watching people interact, being curious, just from a place of seeing how people respond or how they do, or cover how they feel, or pretend not to be bothered. What's going on within that is fascinating. I can watch two people at lunch and be fascinated. What is their relationship? And oh, he's uncomfortable. You know, I was always curious just with that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, younger, I was always kind of curious, you know, seeing people. And I always have a sense of humor. You see fights or screaming matches or dysfunction, and I, you know, bother you, and sometimes then you get, as you kind of make you laugh. You know, it's crazy what people are putting their focus on, right?
Right.
It becomes comedic, I guess.
Anyone who doesn't act, myself included.
But you do.
Well, we all act. But I mean professionally, to do it and to, I think it's such a mysterious internal process for you to go home and take something and come back and make that those words on a page be embodied. And
well, that's the one thing for me as younger, it was the luxury of time. And I always, having the time to really sit and prepare and focus. They get older sometimes, it was amazing. They wouldn't have a script. You'd get started and there's a start date.
Right.
I don't do as well if I don't have the time to daydream about stuff.
Right.
You know, in the nature of how things go, it sounds crazy, but these people are available, this time is available, let's go. And, you know, going back, it was, you know, when you had a smaller film and you sat and waited for financing and you were invested and you were noodling with it, your work was done when you got there. You know, you could have experience. And sometimes you're just catching up on, you know, what is going on exactly here and where is my character coming from, and you're shooting it. But you have to get better, I think, at getting
adjusting
there, getting there more quickly. But there's nothing that replaces, I think, time to kind of think about stuff. And that goes for anything in life, you know, if you have time to think about something before you do it.
Sure.
You have a better experience than if you just kind of go in unconscious. You know?
Sure. You know, I was reading something about True Detective where someone had asked if you took your characters home or if it was difficult to go to that dark place. And you said something I thought was really honest. You said, no, I'm an actor. I mimic, I observe, and I adjust. And that's it. And that's a more technical approach to it, that it wasn't like you have to go to this deep, dark place and come home and scare your kids because you have to be that guy for 3 months or something. And I thought of that idea of, and now that you, it's fascinating that you say you're such an observer, because early in your career you did Psycho, which is a shot-by-shot remake of Alfred Hitchcock's classic. And I thought, well, that's something that almost no actor ever gets to do, which is to observe another actor's performance.
Well, that became almost like pop art.
Exactly, but I wonder what you learned out of that.
Younger, I was much more take it home and stay in it.
Oh, you were?
I felt like I had to. And I liked working from that place. And then there became a thing, I think, when you get older and you get familiar with it, you can actually do a better job. You can't really cheat the preparation. It will get shorter, I think, the more you do it. But you want to get to that place where you're relaxed and you can step into it relaxed. You don't have to punish yourself necessarily,
right,
depending on what it is. As you get older, you just want to feel that you're in the right state when you get to the scene. So however you get there, there's not one way to do
but
it.
But you can't cheat it.
Well, some people are very technical and they can. I'm not as technical that way. I know things and yes, but I don't like to work from that place as much. Maybe it's just the stuff that I watched younger, but I had time and I would come up with stuff. And then as you get older, I think you get good at connecting with parts of it and then being able to drop it and not, you have a trust more, I guess,
right,
that you can do it. But sometimes if you don't have the right time to prepare, there's interesting growth that happens within that too, because you're forced to try to find your way to that feeling of, I feel really within this, you know? And True Detective was interesting from the point of view that the character was written so shell-shocked and insecure in the beginning that I intentionally really wanted to play a guy that was not in his element, that felt try-hard. And really, I know that feeling when you're in those environments where you need it too badly and you can see it on someone when they have that desperation.
Yeah.
So I really tried to be in that state.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think you just, you know that feeling of, I remember going into auditions and literally shaking everyone's hand. You know, I was from the Midwest. I thought you're going to be polite. And it meant so much to me. I wanted so badly to act. So I would go in there so earnest. And then I tried to fool them. Like I was confident, but you could tell underneath that, you know, I hadn't lived with it long enough and understood
it. Right.
I think all actors know that feeling. And you have to get past that, either through getting humiliated so many times that you can't care anymore, right? Or just changing your focus. However it happens, at some point, it can't be more important, the results of it, right, than your own way into it or your own exploration. So I really wanted to bring that in that raw, kind of painful way when people say he seems uncomfortable or unsure of himself. Even the words that he would use, I always saw him as a character that didn't really have a command of the language, but aspired to. And so he would tried, you know, it's like people who overly use big words.
Yes.
It's not even comfortable. So it was that kind of a thing where he can't, it does feel odd coming out and doing it. And then as it progresses, becoming completely relaxed and returning back to what he knows. And Psycho was interesting because I never thought of the value of remaking something, meaning I never saw art as religious in that I thought, well, God, a band does a song, but another band does a song. Or, you know, I've seen the Shakespeare play, Twelfth Night, and then I've seen it done by other people, too. It's material. But to me at the time, Gus had done Drugstore Cowboy and My Own Private Idaho, which was the exciting character-driven films that as actors, that's what we gravitated towards.
Exactly, yeah.
So when that came to me, that's really what I was focused on was Gus Van Sant, this cool character stuff. And he doesn't try hard, and it feels very simple and nice. And I thought, I'd love to do a remake with him. I wasn't prepared or had thought past, what does it mean to remake something? Or are you just, it forced me to go on this journey. But in the execution of it, it was very different way than I had ever worked before.
Would you watch the film?
Well, yeah, it was back and forth. Some days we would. He'd say, we'd watch a scene and we tried to mimic what they did, and then others not as much. So there was an inconsistency. It was a remake.
Yeah.
Some of it's exactly shot for shot.
Yeah.
But some of it's not quite shot for shot.
Well, see, that's, I think, would be the conundrum of how do you make something a remake but also make it your own?
It was interesting. If you were just doing a remake and sticking to the lines,
yeah,
but those particular actors in that setting are finding that blocking, right, or how the scene plays,
right,
you're just interpreting material. That's one thing. But if you're doing that and matching blocking or other things from before, there's something kind of cool in the journey of it, of, because to me it's not always about saying, It's the risk-taking, it's the chances to do stuff out of your comfort zone and sometimes growing and learning during those. To me, the journey is to ride different rides at the carnival. And for the journey of growing, that was like kind of a Warhol, if you will.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Pop art experience where here's a guy who's so grounded in character and doing stuff, but now it's kind of a shot-for-shot remake, and there was a oddity.
Yeah, I would think it would be amazing to, you never study a performance that closely unless you had to for technical purposes, right? Like, you had to study that scene so close.
And yet I didn't watch it. So I would literally watch the blocking of that. I couldn't overly watch and have it in my mind. I had to find my own connection.
That must
my
have
own
been hard.
It was in and out of different processes, but was ultimately really valuable for me and really a good experience. And ultimately it's a director's medium. So there's occasion where you have that relationship where you kind of shut down to the director and don't feel like you're sharing a similar goals, and you survive within that. And then there's other ones where you may not be completely understanding. Maybe that's your lack of comprehension or you're just speaking different languages, but you do value the director and you're trying to fit into their story.
I think in some ways you've been very fortunate that when Swingers came out, you didn't instantly get, I mean, in some ways that character very much became a part of how people saw you, but you were also able pretty quickly to do things like Clay Pigeons and Return to Paradise and some films that were straight up dramas. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, I think their greatest success or failure lies in their choices, being able, saying no to what they say no to or saying yes to what they say yes to. And in your case, I have to ask if it's how deliberate that path has been for you to try to, because you say you want to go on every ride of the carnival, and I think that's
an artist statement.
That's not a. That's
when
not
I say that, I mean you have to be open to different processes, even if you are growing and feel not confident within that. But as far as the choices, you know, I was very much a character actor, independent films, so much, and I really had time to prepare and did these things. And then when Old School came around, I remember the studio did not think I was funny, didn't want to cast me
in
a comedy.
Is that true?
Yeah, they saw me as a real, you know, Clay Pigeons, you know. Swingers is comedic, but it's character. You know, all Return to Paradise, certainly, Cool Dry Place I did for Fox. They were far more character kind of, and odder choices by intention. But I liked Todd Phillips, and I liked the idea, and then I felt very defiant, like I didn't like someone saying to me, no. So I ended up, Todd fought for me, and I got the part, and then that started a run of these movies. And I was always reluctant to a lot of the bigger studio fare, because the stuff that was earnest or dramatic in tone sometimes, you know, felt episodic to me.
Uh-huh.
But our comedies felt kind of punk rock and interesting. We were exploring shit that I thought was fun.
Yeah.
And then I found myself kind of getting into these studio comedies where I didn't understand it, where I didn't know that you were starting without a start date or how it would work, and everyone said it's going to go down. And, you know, Todd's a very good director with a vision, and you realize a lot of times with these movies, it's kind of by committee, or the studio wants a lot of say, which they can, you know, do a good job of it sometimes. But I find that if you don't have someone with a strong point of view that everyone kind of is in alignment with, that what's your mission isn't as clear, especially to an actor. So then you find yourself in movies that sometimes don't have the same aim or point of view, and you're kind of going, you're trying to get something done for a start date, and it's a very different experience. I woke up from that kind of run more recently and you know, said, God, I feel like I've been kind of in a blur with some of it.
It's funny, when you talk about that, I'm reminded, of, I think I read that you said, like on the internship, that it was an R-rated comedy that it got changed to a PG-13 comedy kind of last minute. And
yes,
that it sort of described the frustration of an actor sometimes, that you don't have control over that. You make a decision and
sign
on.
Well, you're learning these things, and I knew from when I started and how we started Defiantly, but I had been on some studio stuff, and you know, you're the actor, so when it starts going in a direction that you don't want, there's a honeymoon period, and all these movies that were PG-13, when they were adult-based, I said, why are we doing them PG-13? Well, it's the same thing. It's this, you're not comfortable with it, you're going, and you're ultimately responsible for it, you know, but you go through these things and learn coming on the other side of them. So internship was an idea I had, and I had written the first draft in a couple weeks. It was very R. It was kind of the fun of getting me and Owen back together, because he makes me laugh. He's got a very, he's a great writer, and he also, a really, really good writer, and he also has a very, very funny sense of humor. So I kind of want to get back to that. And then I gave it off to a production company and a very good director who I'm friendly with, who's very nice and talented guy. But the studio came in and said, well, this needs to be PG-13 because it's not sexual based. But the movie's already kind of going. And then they say, well, we'll shoot it both ways. And fucking weird day, right? Because you're like, well, how do I do that?
That's the death knell in any artistic pursuit. We'll do it both ways.
Well, now you're at the place where, if you're going to pursue it both ways, and what are you really prepared for? You're not going after something, not thinking about something. I mean, fine to do something PG-13, great, but you're doing that, you know? But that would have been a different subject matter. So we did a couple, we saw a lot of R stuff that was really funny early on, and then the writing was on the wall at that point that it was going to be PG-13, and it was, so we just started going. And
right.
I had younger fought a lot or said no to stuff, and, you know, there's good times to do it, but there's also a balance, because if it's not your show, then you have to kind of go along with what the mission is. Where it's fuzzy is sometimes is there's a honeymoon period where everyone kind of says yes, oh yeah, we'll be great, we'll figure it out, not defined, and then when you get there, it changes on you because they kind of want to do something different,
yeah.
Right? And sometimes they're right. In this case, I don't think they were, and it was frustrating because we just got done doing The Watch. Which was originally called The Neighborhood Watch. And the whole kind of point of view of it was this citizens group in a suburban neighborhood that's very safe, that it takes it crime very seriously.
Right.
And of course, there's really no crime to fight.
Right.
But they take it overly seriously. And it turns out to be aliens. But then, you know, the Trayvon Martin incident happened, and the studio really reacted. Our characters in the movie were nothing connected to what that kind of a thing was doing. But the studio made the decision. They said, we're going to call it The Watch. And we're going to let everyone know it's aliens. We're going to steer away from it. So I felt that in the putting of the movie together and the releasing of the movie, they were overreacting to something that I don't think is valid in pursuit of something that was already cast in stone, that was pure in its intention, that had nothing to do with this on either side. And I think they created a little bit of a weirdness. So it was the same studio coming out of that I had sold the internship with, and that was rated R. And because that movie did not work, they oversteered the other way and said, well, let's go PG-13.
Right.
And so they kind of on both sides overreacted and sort of worked from a place that was more based on their handicapping, which, by the way, they're allowed to do and entitled to do. They're the ones releasing the film. But it is a challenging thing when you're in the midst of it.
Sure.
You're trying to figure out, well, let's take this hill. No, stop, let's take this hill. So it gives you a start and stop feeling.
Well, that chasing of the audience, I think, is the definition of when the corporate world gets into an art. And it's always going to be a difficult situation. And
there's, by the way, situations where you're set up perfectly and you go after the thing that you want and it doesn't work out. It's when you're working from the place that you're suggesting. You're, like you said, you're chasing a result and you're handicapping, and so you're not really committing or picking a lane.
Well, I think it's a bold thing to be able to say that and look at why these things happen. I mean, I read this article where you talked really honestly, like, I want to kill off that guy a little bit. And you're really honest in this article about growing and changing. And I think that's, I really relate to that.
But even as you say that, you know, I'm making those choices. I'm making decisions within that and learning coming out on the other side of it. And
right.
There's some good things. You know, I certainly don't regret any of the choices, from things that worked out well. And I've been fortunate to have a lot of things that turned out really well. And then things that didn't. I think there's so many lessons that you learn and grow from in doing it. In life, you know, life is always in your business or your personal, it's always ups and downs. You're always going to learn things, and especially when you're trying different things and going out there. To me, the joy of life, or the way that it works, is you have to go through hard times. And it's one of the things that I think is important as a parent, which is, you know, if I would have had younger someone set me up with a really comfortable road and things were easy for me, I don't know that I would have taken all of the challenges and things that I did.
Right.
And I'm glad that I did, because I had more rejection and humiliation and failures, you know, through all different stages, and great times and great things too. But that's where you really learn about yourself, and that's where you're forced to grow. You know, when things are challenging, when things don't go well, you have to figure out, well, how do I approach this differently and stay resilient? And ultimately, to me, that's what the journey of life is, you know, without that, I think you cheat people maybe out of humility, out of resiliency, out of, you know, empathy and getting to learn about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, the good, the bad, and all of it. But I think that in life, when you're younger, we're all told this is the way that you have to go, or this is what you have to do, or your life won't work out. And then if you're fortunate to kind of listen to those voices that sometimes aren't that loud. Like, people always say, like, it's like a big voice that's calling that comes. I always more felt like something would kind of, like, it kept coming up, but not loud. You know, like you'd get curious about
it's
something.
It's not for sure, right?
No,
it doesn't signal itself.
I was never like, I know this is where I'm supposed to go. It was more like, this seems fun. Should I? Maybe I'll try this. But I don't know. But you just start playing at it.
Yeah.
So much of it's just picking yourself up. You know, and after having the hell beat out of you, kind of cleanses you, and picking yourself up after that, right?
Yeah.
And going forward, that's where sort of the growth, I think, that's where the lessons are. And so I do feel that you kind of could cheat someone out of the best part of life, having to go through those obstacles in love, in relationships.
Yeah.
You know, don't you agree?
It's when you're proving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you don't give someone a chance to prove themselves, or if they don't take that chance,
right,
that is the cheat of life, isn't
it?
Yeah.
I agree with that. And by the way, sometimes it goes terrible.
Yes.
And sometimes it's humiliating. But some of that's good for you, I think. And you're forced to say, well, I better go back to the laboratory. And
well, when I look at your career and look at the careers of my contemporaries that have had long careers, I think that you don't get there without self-reflection. You don't get there without looking at it and saying, okay, am I going to become just the guy who people want me to be, or am I going to take people in a different direction, or am I going to take myself in a different direction? And I think that's a good segue into some of the things you've been doing recently. That, like, when I saw True Detective, it was the first time I watched a performance of yours, and I said, I don't see the kid in there at all. Like, I saw that you took on, in the character of Frank, like, this heavy weight of all man. And by man, I mean maturity, I mean the weight of the world. And it was interesting to me to watch that, Because I don't know if, like you, but I still see myself as sort of 19 from the inside.
For sure.
And I wonder, for an actor, for you, if at some point you stopped and caught a glimpse of yourself and said, oh, wait a minute, I can be a different person now.
It's interesting when you say that. I definitely relate to what you're saying, because I still see myself very much as a kid, in that I never had kind of a really structured routine. So I'm curious about things, and my hours can be inconsistent. I can get in a routine of really getting up early and going to bed, and then I can get in the habit of being up very late, you know.
Which is a very young trait.
Very young trait, right? To give yourself the permission to, like, I'm curious about this, let me just focus only on that, you know,
right.
And then now be interrupted with, you know, family stuff and whatnot. But the parts change. I'm excited about that. I think it's nice to play different stuff. Part of it is you just sort of get to that age, and those are the roles that are coming. But I do agree that you're definitely bringing a different level of life experience and sensibility, and characters that would have had that as well. And so you're kind of drawing on those things.
Yeah. And
you know, they're both unique, you know.
Well, we should say Hacksaw Ridge is your new film, and Andrew Garfield's in it, and he plays a conscientious objector who, through his past, does not want to inflict violence on anybody, and yet feels an obligation to serve his country and wants to be a medic. And so he joins up, and you play his drill sergeant, both in his boot camp and at Okinawa on Hacksaw Ridge. And I just wonder if you walked into that sort of knowing full on what you were getting into, and the technicality of being able to make this film. I'm sure you were up on that hill for a couple months.
Yeah, you know, it started with me. Mel Gibson's one of my, if not my favorite filmmaker. But there is a true story, which is that this very religious man had experiences younger as a kid, and he just really did shall not kill. Thou shalt not kill was really a big deal to him, and just believed that we shouldn't do that. And yet this war breaks out, and he feels an obligation that America's justified in the war, and he feels an obligation to contribute. He's not injured, and he wants to go help. And he wants to go save lives and put people back together. And what this guy accomplished is just insane. Like, when you first hear it, you're going, Okinawa was one of the most brutal, right, modern-day wars. I mean, it's not anything brutal about any kind of war, but it was very close, very, you know, intimate, grueling combat.
Hand to hand.
It was after being in that theater that they decided to drop the bomb, because they realized the amount of lives on both sides that would be lost and how painstaking it was to take that small of an island. So this man was totally convinced and did not want to sacrifice his beliefs or what he felt in his heart was right, regardless of what the populace was saying to him and how they tried to punish him or beat him down. And his kind of courage, I think, is very unique, because it's one thing in a moment where people reacted and did something very brave, and it's very admirable. But this is premeditated.
It was premeditated.
There's a guy from the beginning who takes it on the chin from his own country for his beliefs and for what he believes is right or wrong. And day in and day out, consistently through his calling, continues to show the type of courage that is unfathomable.
Yeah.
So I was blown away by the story of individual, which I'm always a fan of, the individual, whatever their calling is, that they feel strong within their conviction. And
strong enough to be able to
question everything
status
around
quo
you.
And deal with great humiliation or pain from the status quo.
Right. So I was excited and to be included in it. And then personally for me, I have a lot of military in my family. I have relatives who fought in World War II, and my uncles, my father was in the Navy. One of my sisters was in the Army Reserves to pay for college. So I used to go over just unannounced, but I would go when I had Dodgeball or Wedding Crashers or comedies over to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I would show those comedies to the troops, because I figured I had an interesting thing where I don't agree with the wars. I don't know that you can go at gunpoint and tell people how they should live or vote. You know, I don't know that goes well. It feels like it causes a lot more problems than it solves. I felt that way younger. But I really felt for those kids because, you know, war would have broke out. My sister would have gone, you know, at a different time. And I could have seen myself maybe, you know, real younger maybe, saying, oh, well, maybe I'll go in this or something. But so I felt that I wanted to go over there and bring those movies some comedy, some levity. And so I did. So I had been to Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times. And I saw the effects, the PTSD part of it. There's no transition out of it. You know, I don't know why. Even in older, you know, societies, they would always have the troops go somewhere for a couple weeks or 3 weeks and kind of have a reentry process and realize right. they had just come from war. And there was a process to be taken to reenter. You can't unring a bell, but I think you can definitely give some support and have some understanding that you've had friends that you grew up with get killed or seen death, which is, you know, extreme situation. So
it's interesting to hear you talk about that because it's clearly a really satisfying experience for you to be able to make this for not just for entertainment, but it sounds like for you it's on a deeper level.
Yeah, I think what's nice about this is when you have an individual, and this happens to be this guy's calling,
right.
that goes off on that journey, and you're authentically investigating these experiences, I think there's something that's nutritional in that, you know, for the people that get to participate in it, either as a viewer or in working on it, you know, right. It's something that speaks to you.
Right. Well, listen, I feel sometimes at the end of these that we barely scratched the surface of stuff that we could talk about so much deeper, but thank you for sharing this and, like, being so honest about it and actually for, you know, asking stuff about me, which is very odd and uncomfortable. But
why?
No, in terms of being a photographer and photographing so many people and directing so many people over the years, you get a sense that some people, it's a one-way street. And with you talking to you, I just get the sense that you're as curious, as you say, is in everything around you as you are in creating your own career and creating your own thing. So it's fascinating to talk to you.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed, you know, watching this show, and I like the way that you kind of have a conversation.
Wow,
you know,
it feels
kind of easy and fun, and it was that feeling today. So it was nice to get a chance and to hear your points of view and to talk to you about stuff today. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks a lot for doing it.
Thanks, Bo.
All right. Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, writer, and producer Mindy Kaling.
There's so much heartache at that time because everything I'm doing is just like not working out. Like on paper, everyone's like, whoa, pilot, you're working on a network show? And then your own bad pilot rejects you. And then The Office, which I thought was brilliant and great, like people were just pummeling. But I remember being like, I hope I don't have to move home.
Her smart, sharply observed comedy got her hired as a writer on The Office when she was barely out of college. Not much later, it made her boss of her own series, The Mindy Project. But she likely knew she'd be a success long before then. After all, if you can play a convincing Ben Affleck as a 23-year-old Indian-American woman, what further proof do you need? See you next time, off camera.